Thompson Reel 4. Did your first contact with the enemy prisoners surprise you?
No. Actually, my first contact with any prisoner of any importance was the commander of a Goose Green garrison, who was an air commodore, because it was actually an airstrip. Goose Green, that was its importance. And the majority of Argentinians at Goose Green were airfields. There were about 500 to 600 infantry, and the remainder of the garrison, some 1,200, were air force. And this air commodore was brought to my headquarters, and I thought I would greet him personally out of a matter of courtesy. And he spoke exceedingly good English, and he remarked on how much he'd enjoyed a recent visit to London. And I said, I one day hope to visit Argentina. And he said, you're in Argentina now. A reference, of course, to the fact that they claimed Malvinas as part of Argentina.
Did you respond to that?
I just laughed. But the when I actually saw their troops was just after that, down at Goose Green. And they seemed to be pretty demoralized, which didn't surprise me. Though they were quite well equipped, and their clothing was just as good as ours, their boots were a lot better, and their weapons, of course, were about the same as ours. So I wasn't really very surprised. It was more or less as I expected it.
Can we take the story on from the Goose Green now?
Yes. I then told the battalion to stay there and garrison it. We didn't want them recapturing it. And then turned my attention to the moves of my other units, which were going on foot, by which, by that time, three para had arrived at Teal Inlet, and four or five commander had arrived at Douglas Settlement, covering the ground at about three times the rate the locals reckoned they would be able to do it, I might add. And so my main concern was to get them moving on. Now, one of the problems we had was that if a unit was on foot without its bandwagons, BV-202s, it didn't have the secure radio with it, because the only secure radios we had were big ones that had to be carried in these vehicles. So any orders had to be passed over man-pack radios, i.e. ones that could be carried on a man. These were not secure, and therefore could be picked up by the Argentine interception, which was actually quite efficient. And so if you were giving orders to someone to do something in the future, say several hours or even days later, it would give them time, the enemies of them, time to react to it if they were able to intercept it. So as a rule, we either pass messages verbally by sending someone, or I went to see the commanding officers concerned and told them myself. Or if we did have to use the radio, we made quite certain that we only passed messages about events that were going to happen in a few minutes or at least 2 or 3 hours, which would not give them time to react, not give the enemy time to react. Or we would use a very cumbersome code, which was in service at the time called Slidex, which was a very bad code which has now been replaced. The reason I say it was bad is A, it's not very secure, it's easy to break. And secondly, it is very complicated and easy to get wrong. And therefore, you spend hours querying every sentence backwards and forwards, trying to get the message, which again was bad because it gave the enemy a chance to DF your position. So, what I wanted to do was get in my helicopter and go forward and tell my officers what to do next. Well, I got into my helicopter to fly forward, but we then entered a snow blizzard, so it was impossible to get forward. And in fact, that snow blizzard also delayed the fly forward of 4-2 commander, who were going to go forward to Mount Kent. So they were going to hop over the heads of 3 Power and 4-5 commander by helicopter, seize the high ground on Mount Kent, which had already been wrecked and was being held by one of the squadrons, B squadron of 22 SAS. Well, the commando, it wasn't the whole commando, it was a company plus some guns, ran again into the snow blizzard, and the helicopters had set down to see if the blizzard would pass. And you can imagine what it must have been like for the Marines sitting in these helicopters in the darkness, with just the roar of the engines and the helicopters bucking and wallowing in this snow blizzard, with the snowflakes roaring past the doors, wondering if the helicopters were going to fly into the hillsides and crash. And certainly they didn't know what was going to be awaiting them the other end. So eventually the pilot said he can't do it quite rightly, turned around and took the commando back. That same blizzard prevented me from getting forward as well. So I went the next morning, very early, to get the commando and the parachute battalion cranking. And when I got back, I found General Moore had arrived and was in a little cow shed, which was by the settlement where my headquarters was dug in, being briefed by my staff on what was happening. So I walked in and sat down and eventually said hello, and we then went on briefing him as to what we were doing, and he said he was very happy with what we were doing so far, that he was going to land 5 brigade and who were following behind, were about a day behind. They would go down to Goose Green, and that Tupou would then stay under their command, and that I was then to take the whole of my brigade on the axis which I was already advancing on and consolidate on the high ground overlooking Stanley. That I was to keep 40 commando, and I'll come back to them in a minute as well. So I gave the necessary orders, and really the thing rolled from there, because 40 commando were then able to fly forward that night because the weather was good enough. Part of them, and over the succeeding nights, by which time the Chinook had arrived, the one surviving Chinook, which had no spares, no toolkits, no maintenance manuals. So one just had to keep one's fingers crossed that there wasn't anything going to go wrong with it, because there was no way of putting it right. And over a series of nights, 4-2 Commando got onto Mount Kent. 3 para advanced and went onto a mountain alongside Mount Kent called Mount Estancia, and eventually 4-5 Commando, who I'd held back at Teal until my brigade headquarters arrived there and were able to take over the defence of Teal, then marched forward again and marched off to the base of Mount Kent. So by that stage I had 3 units, 3 para, 4-2 Commando, 4-5 Commando forward, and I had 3 gun batteries forward as well, with very little ammunition at this stage, but we hadn't been able to lift it forward. So we were in quite a delicate position, and had the Argentines mounted a concerted counterattack, we would have held it, I'm pretty sure, but it would have been quite a battle without much ammunition for our guns. So I was not best pleased when I heard on the World Service that someone in Whitehall, I think it was Mr. Knott, had announced that the brigade was on Mount Kent and that my headquarters was at Teal, all of which was perfectly true, but I wasn't best pleased to have it announced over the World Service. But as the second thing we were going to use Teal for was bringing supplies in by sea, so that instead of having to lift them by helicopter all the way from San Carlos to the mountains, which was about a 50-mile trip, it was actually about 40 miles in a straight line, but by the time the helicopter used the ground tactically, it was about a 50-mile trip, so it's 100 miles. We then have to refuel each time before it picked up the next load. We could shorten that distance dramatically by bringing the heavy loads in by LSL to Teal, so that it only became something like a 15 to 20-mile lift forward. And the LSLs were going to come in, and they were going to be sitting there in daylight. I held the high ground overlooking it, but if they knew that we had LSLs unloading in Teal, the Argentine Air Force, we thought, would be, their attention would be turned on Teal. And we'd have a difficult time. So I was not best pleased when that happened. The next task for my brigade was to find out as much as possible about the enemy facing them in preparation for the attacks on the hills surrounding Stanley and the break into the main positions around Stanley itself. And so all 3 of my units that I had in the brigade at that time were carrying out intensive patrolling on every night in order to bring back this vital information and also to dominate the enemy and establish moral superiority over them, which they did very successfully indeed. And some absolutely first-class patrolling was done, led by young officers and NCOs, many of them in their early 20s. And it was a very exhausting business because the ground was very rough and very difficult to move over. They could only move at night. And the nights were very long, 14 hours long at that time of the year. And when they came back from their patrol, they weren't coming back to a nice bed somewhere in a warm building. They were coming back to a sodden hole in the peat, covered with a poncho, and lying in a sodden sleeping bag. And they were doing this for something like 11 days, having already, of course, been in these conditions for a number of days before that. But the information they brought back was absolutely vital. At that stage, I kept asking for my other commander, the Foy commander, which had been kept back at the beachhead. I'd actually given them the order to start moving out, and these were rescinding. And General Moore kept them there because there was a threat of an Argentine airborne attack on the beachhead. I, of course, was not best pleased, but we had to put up with it. At that stage, discussions were in progress with what was then divisional headquarters as to what the format, what the design for battle should be for what was going to be the final phase of the war. And eventually, after some discussion, the outline format was that the attack would be in three phases. Phase one would be my brigade seizing Longdon, Harriet and Two Sisters. This would be followed up by 5th Infantry Brigade seizing Tumbledown and Mount William, while I, at the same time, took Wireless Ridge, and then my brigade would then conduct the final push through to the airfield Ispus, hoping by that stage that the Argentine army would have enough if they were penned into a little peninsula off the end. And so those are the orders I gave my commanding officers, and the battle started on the night of the 11th and 12th of June, and it kicked off with three para in the north attacking Mount Longdon, and they had a very hard battle indeed because they could only attack it end on, as it were, and Longdon in sort of rough terms, a rather like king-sized bowling alley consisting of huge rock ridges running parallel across the along the crest, and by as you go down the bowling alley, you have to clear the positions each side of you, because if you don't and you bypass any of them, then they shoot you in the back. And the position on Longdon was held by a reinforced Argentinian company, reinforced by 8 heavy machine guns, manned by Argentinian Marines. This is the .5 Browning machine guns. And these were well sighted and protected by riflemen with night sights. So if a section or a platoon started attacking a machine gun, which it had identified and was suppressing it so that it couldn't fire, then away from a flank, riflemen would open up on the group as it was attacking. So it was a very hard battle indeed. I'd actually told 3 Para and 4 Fire Commander that if they managed to take their positions quickly, they were then to exploit forward onto further positions. They weren't just to stop, they were to keep going, keep the momentum going. But in the event, the battles took so long there wasn't time for them to do this. 4 Fire Commander attacked Two Sisters, and they had a very successful battle up there. Perhaps the most remarkable one of all was the attack on Mount Harriet by 4-2 Commander, because they did a long swing to the south, the route for which had been wrecked by a chap called Sergeant Collins on a series of nights. And they actually came in from the back of the Argentine position, attacking it from the back, which took them totally by surprise. And they took that position, which was the strongest of the three, with the loss of two men dead and 13 wounded, I think, if I can remember the figure right. So the very classic battle, if you believe that the aim is to inflict as much damage on the enemy at the minimum cost yourself, which I think is the aim, they fulfilled that perfectly. Incidentally, for this battle, I was given the Welsh Guards and two para back again to me, as so I had five battalion equivalents. So they were in reserve and able to operate as reserves for either of those three attacks. So by dawn on the 12th of June, we held our objectives, and we were not able to exploit further on because getting light. I wasn't going to attack in daylight. Because incidentally, what I should say is one of the lessons we learned from Bruce Green was that over this very bare, open country, and the fact that the enemy had these 0.5 machine guns, which outranged anything we had as far as direct fire weapons were concerned, except for Scorpion and Scimitar, you would be exposed for very long periods to fire from the enemy without being able to do anything about it, other than retaliating artillery. So I decided we'd do all our attacking at night. Now I realised that the problem with night attacks is control, command and control of your own people in the darkness. But I reckoned that with our people being superior in training to the Argentinians, which is something we'd been able to test at Goose Creek, we really knew that they were, it wasn't just a figment of our imagination, that our commanders would restore order out of the chaos quicker than they could, and therefore we'd all the time be inside their decision and reaction loop, and therefore be able to defeat them, which turned out to be the case. And therefore I was exceedingly relieved when by first light we had all our objectives. The aim then was to get on as quickly as possible, because they were then under fire, of course, from the Argentine artillery, principally 155s, also 105, and taking casualties. It was then the turn of Fire Brigade, and Brigade Commander, quite rightly, of Fire Brigade, asked for a 24-hour delay on his attack, which was going to originally be on the night 12-13, and was postponed to the night 13-14 June, because his people hadn't had a chance to look at the ground, and more important in a way, the gun lines had run out of ammunition. Though they'd stopped to 500 rounds a gun, they were down to just a few rounds on their own position because of the intensity of the artillery fire we put down in the night battle. And there was no way that we could start attacking these positions without artillery support. So on the night of 13-14, Scots Guards attacked Tumbledown, and they were really quick to learn about that. And two power under my command hooked around the top of Mount Longdon to Wireless Ridge. This again was a good way to come in, because the Wireless Ridge position was actually sited to act as a backup for Longdon. So it was really looking towards Longdon, where it was actually attacked like that. And so again, with a well-coordinated attack by two power, using for the first time Scorpions and Scimitars in intimate support, because the ground allowed them to do it. It was sort of rolling ground rather than these steep hills with rocks on top. They, for very few casualties, took out the whole of the Argentine 7th Infantry Regiment, which was holding that position. And at first light on the 14th, we were in a good position with my two powers sitting on Wireless Ridge. The Scots Guards had just about finished their tumble-down battle, and the Gurkhas were about to assault Mount William. I then was summoned forward by General Moore onto some ground overlooking the next lot of objectives to discuss the next phase, and he said, okay, well, the next bit's yours. So I went round to Power to talk to them, went up onto the ridge overlooking Standing. We were actually very close. I remember standing on the skyline looking at it through my binoculars, one of my star folks, and the sergeant major shouted at me, "Get off the skyline, you idle people." And I thought to myself, then, it's a very unpopular thing to do, to stand on someone else's skyline. Very unhelpful. So I flung myself down while chastened at this. And David Chandler, who commanded the battalion at that stage, came up and said, "I think they've broken. I've just seen them all running away." And he had. So I said, "Well, get moving and go forward a bit to establish a position near us, Stanley, while I go back and get the rest of the brigade moving." What I didn't want, of course, the surrender hadn't happened at this stage. I didn't want two powers dashing off into the town and getting surrounded by Argentinians and having a big battle in the town unsupported. And as I was going back, flying back, the radio in my helicopter broke down, as they always do on these occasions. So I couldn't tell anyone to do anything until I got back to my headquarters. I got back, spoke to my brigade major, told him to start getting the brigade moving to advance into Stanley and to move up onto Sapper Hill, overlooking the town. When the order came through from the divisional headquarters that they were surrendering and that there was going to be a ceasefire, but I was still to get on in as fast as I could. So I then got the brigade moving, raced back to Paraguay by helicopter, and then walked into Stanley on the tail of two para, with three para following me, 4-2 commando following them, and 4-5 commando moving parallel to us on the high ground and taking Sapper Hill. And they arrived there at the same time as the Welsh Guards did by helicopter, because Brigadier Wilson had decided to also move his brigade forward, but unfortunately didn't tell us about it. And there could have been a clash, but it wasn't. It didn't matter, it didn't happen. And I was told to stop two para at the race course, old race course. And this was because the general didn't want us breasting up to the Argentine troops as they were withdrawing, and therefore risking an outbreak of firing again. And I eventually stopped them. They were all for racing on, but I managed to stop them eventually. And I then went on myself with some of my staff to find out what was going on, see if I could find the enemy general. So I went on to what was in fact the Secretariat building, which was on the edge of the main bit of Stanley. And it was a bit strange, actually, sort of walking around amongst all these armed enemy soldiers, just as fearless. And I asked an Argentine military policeman, who we came up against, who asked us what our business was, because by that time we were all looking pretty scruffy, pretty dirty, and I didn't think he could sort of make out our rank badges or anything. He said, "What are you doing?" He spoke to my leader. So I said, "Is my general there?" Because I'd been told, wrongly as it turned out, the general was flying forward right then to conduct the surrender, and I thought by going forward I could meet him and say, "You know, we're here, tell him what we were doing." And it turned out he wasn't. The Argentine said, "No, there's no English general, there's just my general," meant Menendez, plus two British officers. And I knew who they were. They were actually Bell, Captain Bell, and Colonel Rose, who were coming to SAS, and I knew, because I'd been told this would happen, they were conducting the preliminaries to the negotiation of the surrender. And I knew that Mike Rose, who wanted to come to SAS, was a very experienced hostage negotiator. And Rob Bell, who was a Spanish speaker, would not want what I hoped would be the rapport that they were setting up with Menendez to be fractured by a sort of gash brigadier wandering in and disturbing the proceedings. So I turned on my heel and went back. And by that time it was getting near dark. We managed to persuade one of the companies, two power B company, to let us have a room in the house that they had requisitioned. And so I moved my small pack headquarters into that. Because my main headquarters was miles away, and that was out of a minefield with the bandwidth. It didn't catch up with us for 2 days. We hadn't eaten anything for about 24 hours. The soldiers of Tupac hadn't eaten anything for about 72 hours. And we found some Argentine rations in this house, which had been occupied, I think, by some Argentine staff officers. All of one of the rooms that was stacked with tins of Argentine bullied beef and tins of tomatoes and plastic bottles of red wine and all the rest of it. And the B company, Tupac, lit the peat Rayburn stove in the kitchen and put a huge pot, which they found, and tipped all the stuff in, heated it up, and we sort of stood round it when they'd finished and they'd had their way. We then cooked up ours and we stood round it, sort of dipping our spoons in, eating this stew off the top of the stove. I then summoned all my commanding officers to me and gave them their orders for the night, because I wasn't sure if they were going to surrender, and that we didn't want to be attacked in the night and let our guard drop. So I gave them their arcs of responsibility, and I told my gunner that his guns were to be laid on where the Argentinians were, I reckoned, with the gun sentries, you know, right by the lever, so that when anyone shouted fire, just pull the lever in the first round and go straight away onto these pre-selected targets. And by this time, well and truly dark, and I can't remember exactly when it was, but I guess it must have been around 8, 9 or 10 at night, local time. One of the radio operators with me turned his HF set, which could receive England, provided he stuck an arrow out of the window, high frequency set, and he turned it to World Service. And I actually heard on the World Service the announcement of the surrender from the BBC 8,000 miles away. It was actually taking place 800 metres away from where I was standing in the Secretariat building. So by that time, General Moore had flown forward in the dark and had actually finished the surrender negotiation, which had obviously been passed back to London immediately and been released to the World Service. So I heard it sort of from somewhere 800 metres away. It had gone to London and back to me. And then right after that, Rod Bell came back from the surrender negotiations to my headquarters. I said, "Is what I've heard correct?" He said, "Yes, it is correct. That's it." And I must say, I felt profound relief that no more of our young men, anyway, were going to have to die in this war, and it was over. It was a pretty emotional moment.
Did you meet General Menendez then?
Never met him.
Who was the most senior Argentine you met?
The most senior Argentine chap I met was the Air Commodore Goose Green. Because by that time, as it were, all the negotiations obviously had been carried out by General Moore, who was my superior. So there was no need for me to meet Menendez. And then very quickly after that, the senior officers were removed. And